Hello, this is the Media Report on RN, Radio Australia and the ABC Radio app. I'm Richard Adie. We're going to begin this week with the scandal in the World Game. As you've probably heard, Swiss police have arrested seven officials from FIFA, football's governing body, after US investigators alleged massive corruption. 14 people have been indicted, including Jack Warner, the powerful former head of CONCACAF, the regional football federation for Central and North America. Rumours have swirled around Warner for years, and no journalist has done more to investigate them than Lozana Libert. I spoke to the Trinidadian a short time ago, and he began by telling me how he's often been pressured to ease off.
Generally, the warnings would be, you're risking your career by writing this stuff. You're not going to change anything. Everyone will forget the story in 2 weeks anyway, you know, so don't stick your neck out. Those were the, you know, the type of stuff that, you know, I would hear.
When did you first begin having a really hard look at Jack Warner and at CONCACAF?
Early on, I realized that a lot of what happened on the field and our team's chances of qualifying were affected a lot by things that were happening off the field. And I felt it would be dishonest to just write match reports, you know, part match day on the field, but part looking into the administrative offices as well to see what they were doing.
And am I right in thinking that Jack Warner has at least threatened to take legal action against you in the past?
He has threatened. He actually has taken legal action against me once. He sued on a technicality based on the Haiti scandal recently. If you remembered, aid money was given to Jack Warner as CONCACAF president, and more than 75% of that money was not related to Haiti.
Yes.
So I represented myself, and if I were to, you know, drag all my resources into the case, you know, I would be sure to lose no matter what the outcome was. And just before it went to court, his lawyers called to just drop it out of court.
So how well received in Trinidad has been your approach to covering him? Because he's a very well-known figure. He's a very powerful man.
Yes. I would say for the last 24 hours at least, everyone has been patting me on my back. I can assure you that doesn't always happen. You know, a lot of the times, more times than not, it's sort of lonely. And the people who are directly affected, you know, they would tell me, you know, they appreciate what I do. But more times than not, you know, people think, what's the point? You can't break him. He's too powerful. You know, you're just wasting the time. But, you know, the last 24 hours, I didn't feel vindicated, but a lot of people were very appreciative of my work.
Yes. I wonder how you feel about how football journalism generally does in covering this kind of story, because most resources, most people, they're about how the teams are going, what the superstars, which clubs they're going to, about the game itself, not about this backroom stuff, which is where so much of the money is.
Football reporters are mostly fans. And we'd all like to sit in the stand and just look at great matches and great players, you know, do their thing. We all like that. You know, but I think we just need to be honest and honest to our readers too and get stuck into the other things that we know really matter. But I think all over the world, probably maybe 80, 90% of sport writers prefer to look at the game. They don't want to risk their accreditation or making enemies and losing access to players and access to games and so on. And they just do the nice bit.
So how much do you think there is still to come out? How many more stories, how many more years worth of stories do you think you've got to write?
I'll be doing this for as long as I can. I think that football is rotten to the core. You can't stop writing. You know, there could be 100 of me here, and we still wouldn't get everything.
And it wouldn't be the only football federation in the world that where there will be more hard questions asked. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Lozana Liebert, editor of Wired868.com. This is the Media Report with me, Richard Adie. Now to events that began 10 years ago on Father's Day.
A Father's Day outing has ended in tragedy with the drowning deaths of three children in the Victorian country town of Winchelsea. The boys were travelling with their father when their car veered off the road and plunged into a dam.
Unfortunately, he made efforts to get all three children out of the car and he was unable to.
The defence argues that Farquharson had a coughing fit that caused him to lose consciousness and drive his car into the dam with the boys in it.
But police were convinced it was a deliberate, hateful act. Their reconstructions backing their belief he'd driven off the road, veering around a tree to reach the dam.
There were emotional scenes outside the Victorian Supreme Court after a jury found Robert Farquharson guilty of triple murder.
You had a burning resentment that you were financing your estranged wife's new life, he said. She had the better house, the better car, the children, and now she has a new relationship.
Rob was never likely to receive a fair trial because any potential jury has been deeply influenced by emotive and selective reporting from the media. Despite the fact that it is hard to accept, this was an accident.
Well, it's turned out not to be. Robert Farquharson was found guilty of murdering his three sons. He appealed, his conviction was overturned, and he was retried. He was found guilty again. Farquharson was unsuccessful in his bid to appeal to the High Court. The whole process took the best part of a decade, and the writer Helen Garner became a kind of court reporter to cover it all. But why this case?
The thing is that when you get interested in a case like this, especially if it's one that goes on for years, your attention is sharpened to similar cases. And it's not uncommon, a case where a parent kills a child, particularly a father or a stepfather. They're not that rare. In fact, it's quite shocking how many of them crop up again and again all over the world. So it's not the first case I've written about of somebody murdering a child. The first one I wrote about was Daniel Valerio back in the 90s. But that was just a couple of weeks' work. But this one went on for what seemed like an eternity. And I often did wish that I had never heard of it.
Yes, that was where I was going to go next. I mean, it isn't your first time of following a case and writing a book about it. Did you this time consciously do things differently in a journalistic sense?
Yes, I was one major thing I did, which was I didn't do it. The book is not based on interviews, like, for example, Joe Cinque's Consolation, which contains a lot of interview material. As usual, with after the first Farquharson trial, my first thought, as in a sort of journalistic way, was, okay, now I start interviewing people. But I approached both sides of the family, and neither side wanted to be interviewed. And my first response was, oh, hell, well, I suppose I can't really go on without interviews. And then it suddenly struck me that if I didn't do interviews, if I backed off and detached myself from the story, I might have a stronger chance of getting a handle on it in some useful way. So that's when I realised that the way to do it was to concentrate on the court hearings and make those the central drama, as it were.
Yeah, and as a former reporter who's spent a lot of time in courts, it was really interesting to me the way you've taken these things that mostly nobody ever touches upon and made them part of the main event. And one of the things is how you can hear essentially two completely different takes on an incident from the two different sides, as it were. And the first one sounds plausible and convincing, and then the second one sounds plausible and convincing as well.
Yes, I suppose that's the sort of gist of this book, really. And I'm aware that as I sat through those trials and sat with the story year after year waiting for the next hearing, because you know, the hearings, as they developed, were separated by long periods of time, like a year, I found my sympathies swinging from side to side as it went on. And that was part of the awfulness of trying to stick with the story over such a long time.
Did you try and develop a system to process so much information? There's lots of complexity, actually. It sounds like a simple story at its heart, but in fact, it became a very complicated one. Did you try and find a way of keeping on top of that?
Well, I'm actually not one of the world's great planners. I tend to sort of rush higgledy-piggledy into a story, then find when once I've passed the point of no return, then I start trying to find myself some structures. I worried because there were two trials. I mean, he was found guilty in the first trial, and because of some errors that the judge made in his charge to the jury, he got a second trial. But there was a lot of technical evidence in there, and it was the evidence of the physics of how the car actually got into the dam. And that was very a vexed matter. And I realised that, you know, I thought I'd boiled it down in the first trial, in my account of the first trial, so that people could get a handle on it and not sort of die of boredom. But then when, of course, the same evidence came up again in the second trial, and I was just in despair thinking, how on earth am I going to write it in such a way that people will remember what they need to know from the first version of it, but see how it sort of subtly shifted in the second. And of course, in the second trial, I came to the point where I thought the physics of the police measurements and calculations of arcs and flat arcs and curved arcs and things like that was almost incomprehensible to the layperson.
We should just say this is how the car got from the road into the dam, which wasn't immediately adjacent to the road. It's a bit of a distance.
No, on contrary, it's very close to the road.
But the path was, how many metres?
70, I think. Maybe less, I can't remember. But, you know, I've been down that road. It's a flat volcanic country. You drive along and suddenly there's this overpass, a man-made overpass, and you approach it. You go up the overpass, and which has got a slight curve to it, and you go down the other side, and suddenly, boom, there's this dam on the right. And it's very close to the road. I was shocked when I drove down the first time. But see, he was driving in that direction. In order to get into the dam, I first thought he must have taken a left, you know, just gone left off the road. But he'd have to cut right across the road, across the oncoming lane, and through a fence, across a paddock, and into this very, very deep dam, which was actually not a farm dam with sloping sides, but a pit left over from where the road makers had dug it out to make the overpass.
7 metres deep.
Yes.
Were you at all struck by the difference between what you were doing and what the daily reporters were doing, who faced these constraints of at least a daily deadline, and I imagine with the radio journalists more than that. And that kind of constriction, it actually means that your purpose is very clear.
Yes, you're under terrific time pressure. And because I didn't even have a contract at this point when I was sitting there in the court. I hadn't signed a contract, I hadn't taken any money, I didn't have a deadline. And I was at liberty to basically sort of wallow in the story as it developed. This was, in one sense, a great luxury. In another sense, it was like being on a leg rope for 8 years or 7 years, however long it took. And the journalists, I'm sure, didn't find the story any less horrible and painful as I did, but they had to work faster, they had to think faster, and they had to make judgments faster or sort of make judgments that made it possible for them to actually say something.
In fact, as a former radio reporter in big court cases, you're looking for that thing that you can say next each time.
Yep.
So the next hour, you've got to find something different or new or recap what's just happened. There's always a demand.
I noticed that there would be certain points in the evidence where suddenly a couple of journalists would jump up and run out of the court. And I'd say, that's the point they're going to make with their report. Whereas I'd just quietly write it down and go home and have to sort of torture myself about it at 2 a.m. for 7 years.
You are struck, actually, and you write about this briefly, fairly early on by the kind of the professional hardness of the reporters covering the case.
Yes, and I don't see how people could survive without that carapace of toughness. I was speaking at the Sydney Writers Festival the other day, and a young woman got up and said that she was a court reporter, and she said, "Have you got any tips about how to sort of bear this work?" She said, I said, "Well, what do you do to bear it?" And she said, "I drink. I go on these benders." And I really felt for her.
It gets me to something else, or a couple of things, actually. Do you think, or how could, trials be covered better? How could we, as citizens, understand this better because of what the journalists tell us?
People have done studies about the sort of person in the street and their attitude towards criminals, particularly murderers, and you know, how you often read in the tabloid press that they're screaming for longer sentences and screaming for, you know, in a muffled way for the return of the death penalty. But when people are given access to more detail about how a case was run, or the crime itself, or the person who committed the crime, if they're given access to an enormous amount more detail than you get from reading the papers or watching the news on TV, they tend to take a much more merciful line.
Well, maybe we should let cameras into courtrooms in the way that they do in many courtrooms in America.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I worry about how people sort of play up to cameras.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was struck by what you were talking about before, which is that if people go to trials, they tend to find it a more complex thing. And what you've done in the book is you've illustrated that the barristers, it's their job to take a set of human decisions with all the context and make it into something stark and simple.
Yes, really, it's a contest between two stories, I suppose.
Yes.
And some people are better at telling stories than others, and some sets of events lend themselves to simple stories more than others. See, in the Farquharson trial, he really only had one defence, which was that he said he'd had a coughing fit and blacked out at the wheel. And that's why there had to be so much evidence about how the car left the road, to see if, the sort of tracks it left and the arc that it took stack up with the idea that the driver was unconscious.
Helen, we have to wrap this up, but one thing I am interested in knowing is, would you do this again?
Oh, I don't know. Look, I'm getting kind of old. That in a way equips me quite well to do this sort of work, because I've actually been around long enough to know a bit about what human beings are like, and to stack up what I'm seeing in front of me with my own experiences or my own knowledge of the world. But, gee, it's grueling. It's hard, hard work. There's an enormous degree of anguish that goes along with writing about these things, and I just don't even know if I could tackle that again.
I'm glad you did. Helen Garner is the author of This House of Grief. You'll find details on our website at abc.net.au/radionational. I'm Richard Adie, and you're with the Media Report. It was interesting hearing Helen Garner talk about the young court reporter she met the other day at the Sydney Writers' Festival, because there's no doubt that some stories take their toll on the journalists who cover them. Sometimes this price can be very high, post-traumatic stress disorder. Professor Richard Bryant is a psychologist at the University of New South Wales who's been working with the DART Centre for Journalism and Trauma. He says journalists face unique pressures.
The sort of things that they would present with would be, they might get exposed to something very, very nasty, very grisly. But then it's the nature of journalistic work where you might, rather than just walk away from that, you've then got to be processing that and reprocessing it for maybe 24, 48 hours, getting it right for when it's finally going to go to either print or airing or whatever. So you've got to keep looking at these images or refining the story. Plus, you've actually got a huge editorial deadline you've got to meet. And so even though you might be thrown by what you've seen and been involved with, you've still got this huge pressure to perform and get it done on time. And that actually, in terms of the stress response that we know humans typically have, really is quite a difficult process.
So that's two things. One is that you might have to engage with what is disturbing to view or experience over a prolonged period of time, compared to, say, a paramedic who goes and deals with something and then goes and deals with something else. And the other thing is the deadline pressure that forces you to do this processing and try and get to grips with it quickly. You can't get away from it.
No, and what's particularly interesting about that is that we've learnt a lot in the last few years about the initial 24, 48 hours is really important in terms of how trauma memories get consolidated in the brain. If the stress hormones are firing, if you like, at very high levels, it means the memories get very, very strongly consolidated. And this is important because this is the fuel that leads to things like post-traumatic stress disorder, because these memories keep coming back, or the nightmares keep coming back. And so what we typically want to do is see in the very acute phase that there's a reduction in arousal. But journalists and other news professionals aren't afforded that. They have to stay with it. Now, if that wasn't enough, we also have a lot of complaints by news professionals that when they do cover something, their job is to cover it. It's to report it. It's not to intervene. It's not to become part of the news story. And so they have to, in a sense, have a rather detached perspective of it. And so many times we've had people report helplessness, that the sense that they've seen, you know, difficult things in a war zone or a humanitarian crisis, and they can't really do anything. But that leaves them with residual feelings of, you know, what could I have done? And then that can get compounded by public sentiment. And very often you can be in a situation and you can, well, be vulnerable to much criticism, that you were there and in a sense you're there as a voyeur, you're taking pictures or you're covering a story, but really, what are you doing other than that?
And actually, with the rise of social media, public sentiment now is something that journalists are much more aware of than they used to be.
Extremely, and it's real time. So it's a very different ballgame than what it was 10, 20 years ago.
Can I ask you about something else that's different from 10, 20 years ago? And that is that what has happened to the newspaper part of journalism in particular, but really all forms of mainstream media have been squeezed. Is that, do you think, having an effect on how journalists are responding when they're put in what might be traumatic situations?
I think it definitely does in several ways. We know from a lot of work that how people are developing and coping with a stress reaction can be caused by trauma, but it's also contributed to a great deal by organisational stresses. That often is the largest contributor to the ongoing problems that people have. Now, with what's currently going on in terms of the landscape of the news media, jobs are under threat. And so very often people will be, you know, required or invited, if you like, in inverted commas, to, you know, go to a war zone or go to some place that's very, very dangerous to cover a story. Now, if they're not willing to do it, then without much disguise, their job is at risk. And there'll be other people who will be able to do this.
You realise if you're a correspondent who's based overseas, that essentially the organisation that sent you there own you, and they can direct you to go wherever they want you to go at whatever time. I think everyone knows that bargain, but there are obviously times when you're exhausted, you've perhaps seen things that you weren't expecting to have to confront, and it might be harder to get on the next plane.
Exactly, and you just don't have the chance these days to really say no, because if you do, then there's a real price to pay professionally. Now, often when people talk about post-traumatic stress and journalism, etc., you know, we do think about the embedded journalist, the war correspondent, etc. But I do want to emphasise that there's actually a lot of other people who are affected. And the sort of people that we often see as well are often the cadets and the junior journalists, for example, who might be in some regional part of Australia, where very often they're the only person there, they have no support, and very often they might be, the first person to arrive at a highway crash. Mm. There's mangled bodies, fatalities in front of them, and this person might only be in, you know, 20 years old or something, and they have to deal with that. Now, they're not going to get a lot of the support that people would often get in the larger news networks, and yet the long-term effects on them can be very, very compelling.
The other group of people I'm wondering about, Richard, are the producers who aren't perhaps in Afghanistan or at the car crash, but they see all the pictures. And they often see pictures that will never be put to air for a general audience because they're too much.
Oh, yes. And that's anybody in the business knows that's the vast majority of the material that's shot. There's been a lot of work done in the last few years, mainly with police officers and military and drone operators, in terms of those who have to watch electronically very graphic events. But to be honest, those who are editing, you know, visual material in the news profession is exactly the same. You know, they're still watching this thing and often watching it over and over again and different variants of it. And that is a very, very wearing experience.
All right. I think I've got my head around now how journalists are kind of their own case. Are you able to give me, a simple indication of what you've changed about other programs to tailor them for journalists?
Let me say that we start off by the evidence-based treatments that we have. When PTSD is the problem, we do know basically what is going to be the right approach. And that approach is typically a what's called a cognitive behavior therapy approach that very much involves addressing the trauma memory, but then being able to think about it in a particular way. This has to be relived in an emotive way, because our goal is to be able to teach people that these memories don't need to be feared anymore, which allows people to actually get over the core symptoms of PTSD. The other sort of very, very core aspect that we need to change a lot is their beliefs or their thoughts, which does emanate a lot from the sort of experiences they go through and their role in them. So the notion that I did not do enough, the notion that I should have intervened, the notion that I should have saved this person, or the criticisms that I got from these people that I should have done more. Those sorts of pressures, they often have a lasting impression on how a person perceives the world and also how they perceive themselves. So we would actually have a very targeted sort of approach, again, that takes a number of sessions, that leads a person to really think realistically, not positively necessarily, but just have a realistic evaluation. And this is where journalists are very, very good, because they typically tend to be quite savvy. And so being able to work with them to be able to do that sort of reality testing, you know, is sort of the other core component.
So you want to run a trial now of what, different methods of delivering this program? Is that it?
Well, what's remarkable is that we know that this whole occupation, it's one of those occupations that's highly exposed and more at risk of developing PTSD. But as a field, we know nothing. We have no evidence, you know, to say, okay, specifically, what's the best way to treat these people? So what we're wanting to do is to do the first trial where we're actually going to take the intervention that we've been doing for a while in our clinic and deliver it in two ways. And we're delivering it on the basis of what we've already had from feedback from all around the world, that journalists are basically nomadic. So we're going to take advantage of Skype, and we're going to have a clinical psychologist who will be actually providing the treatment for people. It's individual, it's confidential, it goes over about 8 sessions. Alternatively, we wanted to do a self-help program. So we're going to have exactly the same components, nothing changes, but people are going to be provided with this manual, and they can work through it at their own pace. Because that also has been shown to be a very, very effective intervention, to see how do these two compare. So either way, by the end of it, we'll actually know what is the best way to help journalists. And this is really important, I think, for the industry, because in terms of employers, they do have a responsibility. So actually having evidence, this is very important in terms of policy, in terms of compensation law, in terms of the due rights that an employer has in terms of looking after its employees.
Richard Bryant is Professor of Psychology at the University of New South Wales. And if you're interested in finding out more about the trial, or perhaps you know someone who is, go to our website. You'll find a link to Richard's clinic. We're at abc.net.au/Radio National. Then click on the media report, abc.net.au/Radio National. My thanks today to producer Carter Slavin. She has really moved mountains. Our sound engineer is Joe Wallace. I'm Richard Ady. Thanks for listening.